The following talk was given by Steve Matushak at Dharma Field Meditation and Learning Center in Minneapolis on June 29, 2025. This talk may not be played or reproduced for profit.
Good morning. You made it. Apparently we had a heck of a storm last night, and I really only learned a bit when I got up this morning just to see what the temperature was going to be like, because I'm like, well, what shirt should I wear this morning? And I looked at my phone and it said, warning, tornado warning, you know, and I just went, what? And when I went outside to get into my car, I started seeing branches lying around in my yard, and one of my neighbors lost their house. It was the squirrels in my backyard, but still a big squirrel nest lying in my backyard. So that was kind of sad, but I didn't see any serious damage in my neighborhood, but clearly something happened. And as many of you know, I have hearing problems. So if I have my bad ear up, a bomb can go off and I'll never know what's happening. So I had no idea that this happened. So I'm glad you all survived. Nice to see you all this morning.
It's actually noisy.
What was that?
Yeah, it was noisy.
Yeah, yeah. I'm really surprised I did not wake up. Sometimes somebody, and I won't say the person's name, will wake me up to let me know there's a storm going on. But my cat didn't even wake me up to let me know. Well, this morning I'm going to give a talk that I've titled Living Out of Our Dreams. And I want to start talking about, I think I mentioned this, some of you were here last week. It was kind of a hot day, so we had sort of a small group here. And I had just returned from being in the Boundary Waters. So all of last week, not this past week, but the week before, I was in the Boundary Waters and had an adventure up there, right? So initially the idea was just take it easy. My husband and I had done a trip just a couple of years ago. It was my first Boundary Waters trip, and there was a portage in there where you have to carry your gear and your canoe for sometimes, you know, up and down hills for a distance. And it seemed so arduous that I went, we're not going to do that again, right? So it's true. We didn't do it again. We did it way, 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 way worse. We did a lot of portaging. So there was a lot of, like I said, a lot of adventure that was part of that. But there was also this incredible deep peace and quietude that was directly accessible to me when I was there, right? And it was most, one could assume, oh, I know what he's talking about, because these moments existed, right? After we had humped all of our gear, and I was kind of going over it again with my husband, we were looking at the trail and, oh, it is kind of a big loop, isn't it, right? And we were doing what they call I don't know if they call it double portage, but basically we had so much gear that we couldn't carry it all once. So we had to go out and then come back and then carry it out again. So every one of those portages was multiplied times three. And I was looking over again our second day, and it was a lot of portaging. I remember joking to somebody when we were finally leaving the Boundary Waters and they were coming in and we were talking about our experience. And I said, yeah, you know, we were portaging so much, it felt like a backpack excursion where we were carrying a canoe around for some reason. It just seemed like it was more walking. But anyhow, when all that's done, right, so you can imagine the peace and quietude, when all of that is done and you're settled down and you have no obligations at the moment, and you just sit, which is what I would do. We had these little, I don't know, they're chairs, there's like cushions that clasped together and you could just sit in them, that they kind of hold you upright. And then just look at our backyard, you know, which was amazing. And this peace, this quietude would be right there, right there. But that peace and quietude I also experienced when we were going up and down rocky, muddy hills, you know, with 50 pounds of weight on my back and carrying oars, you know, with gloves on because mosquitoes are biting us and mesh over my face. But that quietude and that peace was there in that as well. As long as I wasn't going, ah, mosquitoes are somehow getting through those gloves, which, you know, if they're patient, they'll just sit there and they'll try to get that nose in there, you know. But when you can just allow it, it's right there. And what was amazing to me, you know, so what we're doing in those moments, by the way, we're shaking loose our dreams of the world, right? Or getting out of our head in those moments where we really experience that peace and quietude. And when we're doing those tricky portages, you got to get out of your head or you're going to stumble. So whenever I was tripping, it's because I was thinking about something. If I was stumbling or, you know, at risk of tipping over, it's because I was thinking about something else. So you have to get out of your head. You have to be open to this. And then that peace, that quietude is accessible to you. But what I realized as I was experiencing that was that I was also, I don't know how else to put it, but I could feel the source of the quietude. I could get to its source. It wasn't just this surface feeling of peace. It was like I could get at something. And I want to restate that, and I'm going to read it because I put it in a way that I think kind of gets at it. So you can feel the source of quietude, or rather, you can feel that quietude is none other than the source. And the source is quietude. You really can feel that. It's what Katagiri called the source of existence. Everything just is, quietly, completely working out reality. And by quietly, I don't mean no sound. Because even when you're in the boundary waters, though there are those moments, no sound. But there are also moments when you hear birds or you hear your boots clomping on the ground. You know, so it's not no sound, but reality just doesn't call attention to the fact that it's working. Hey, look what I'm doing. I mean, it's just quietly working out. All beings, that's all of totality, all beings seemingly separate, all these seemingly separate things working together seamlessly. Whole. A whole. Whole. Each thing wholly doing what it does. And guess what? That's right here. It's not just in the boundary waters. It's right here. And it's available to us right now. But we so easily lose sight of it. Right? And it really is something that's just right. It's just right here. And people will ask, well, if it's right here, how come I don't see it? Well, there are reasons why we don't see it. And one of them, I'll just give you some examples. We have a room to gather in. We have chairs or cushions to sit on. We have a talk to listen to. I don't know if you can hear what's going on there, but I discovered this passage in a book. I've been giving talks at Sesshins, which is our meditation retreats that we have here roughly every month to 2 months at Dharma Field, at least from September through May. And I've been giving talks from Steve Hagen's book, Buddhism is Not What You Think. And I came across the description he had of being in the boundary waters. And it was a lot like I was just describing. And then he came up with this at the end of the chapter, right? That to me seems to help us to see how it is that we lose sight of it when we're right here. Steve writes, in the city, for better or worse, everything is planned. Everything is put there for some purpose, for good or ill, convenience or decoration. Nature, on the other hand, is unintentional. Nature doesn't try to do anything, produce anything, or accomplish anything. Nevertheless, nature does produce a great deal. But nature produces things in a radically different way than human beings generally do. Most human actions come out of our intentions, our desires, our attempts to bring about certain situations, and our yearning to prevent other situations from occurring. In contrast, what nature produces is without purpose, intention, or will. This is because there is nothing outside of nature for it to act on or against. So in nature, everything is just what it is, just as it is. We saw some frogs when we were out, and they made some fun noises. I saw a really big frog in one of our portages. And I was thinking to myself, you know, a frog doesn't tell itself, if only I could be a better frog. You know, maybe lay off the dragonflies and stick to the mosquitoes. I don't know. It's hard for us to imagine that. They don't have ideas about the world or their place in it. And this is important. This really became clear to me while I was living with them. It's because they don't have ideas about the world and their places in it that they are the best frogs that they can be. That frog we saw couldn't be any better a frog than it was. And oh my God, I don't know what frog it was, but some frogs were getting really busy too, because we were portaging at one place and we saw, I don't know how many tadpoles, but it was thousands of tadpoles. It was absolutely astonishing. But unlike the frog, human beings have all kinds of ideas about the world, and then we act, think, and speak from those ideas. And actually, when I was writing this talk, this is where the title of my talk comes from. I was thinking, well, ideas doesn't really get at it. Remember, the title of my talk is Living Out of Our Dreams. Ideas doesn't really get at it, because ideas feel like something you can accept or not accept. You have an idea. Yep, that's a good one. That's not a good one. But dreams, think about the way that dreams operate. They operate in this way. So long as they're unfolding, we just accept our understanding of what's happening as reality, even in lucid dreams. Even in those dreams, you go, yep, I'm dreaming right now, right? But that's the reality that we accept, as long as that dream's unfolding. So human beings are doing that same thing. Just as this dream is unfolding, as I'll get into the dream in a moment, as it's unfolding, we accept that as our reality. And I think that dream can show up in a couple ways. One dream that we have when we're dreaming the world into being is we have ideas about what the world is, what it is, what this is. We have ideas about what this is, what its reality is. And then we also have another kind of dream. That's our dream. That would be what we would maybe think of as our dreams, our hopes, our aspirations, and our desires. And that's how we dream the world into being, how it is, how we would like it to be. And that's our human world. Because guess what? We're all doing that. We all do that. We all have ideas about how the world is, and our hopes, dreams, and desires. And all of its, and I want to make sure that you understand this, and all of its magnificence and pain and suffering. That's how it works. So then you hear that and you might say, well, and then you go to the boundary waters and you have an experience like I was talking about, or you read a passage like I just read and you go, well, if only this could be like the boundary waters, like it is in nature, without any intention, then everything would be great. And we do that without realizing that's another dream. That's another dream. If only it were like something else. And we can hear the dream in that. We can hear the dream of the way it's supposed to be and how we would like it to be. And when we hold on to that dream, then we can't allow this to be as it is. No, the world should be like this. I want it to be like this. We can't allow people to show up as they are. Oh, no, we don't behave like that. Buddhists don't do that. So we have problems with that. We don't allow people just to show up as they are. And this is something we talked about last week. We had a little conversation here for those of you who were a part of it. Know that we did. But we know that the difficulty is sometimes this is hard. This is difficult and hard for us because they are difficult and hard for us. And by they, I mean the circumstances And in our conversation last week, we saw the circumstances can be personal circumstances, the stuff that's going on in our life immediately, or social circumstances that are going on that we look at and we struggle with, that we find difficult and hard. The same thing with people that are close to us, with those who aren't, but that we have difficulties. That's why this is difficult. And honestly, when we encounter that, especially if it's something that feels like it's in our little circle of influence, then we think, well, I can control that. I can do something to make that other person do what I want them to, right? Or I can make conditions such that I can control them, that they can conform to my dream. And again, just remember, we're all doing this. This is what we all do, right? I heard an anecdote a while ago, and I had forgotten about it, but Cindy Cuccia reminded me of it recently that I want to share with you that I think kind of gives some insight on this. And that's a story that Edward S.B. Brown told. I don't know if you know who Edward S.B. Brown was, but he was the Tenzo at, I think the first Tenzo at Tassajara. It's a Zen monastery, first American Zen monastery, and it's south of San Francisco in the mountains there. Edward S.B. Brown is the author of, a lot of people know from the Tassajara Bread Book, or a book that we have here at our Dharmafield kitchen, Tomato Blessings and Radish Teachings. And this story is from that. And I remembered encountering it, and I always loved this story, but one of the things about Edward S.B. Brown, he'll tell you, he doesn't have a real long temper, meaning like it doesn't take a whole lot to set him off. And he found his kitchen staff to be not quite up to snuff, right? And sometimes that would just drive him mad. Like one of the, he was saying, sometimes people come to work or they take long breaks, and I'd watch them working and they didn't seem to be very present. He goes, and this is what I love. He goes, I couldn't tell what they were doing, but the rice would take a long time to get washed. You know what I mean? And if you've ever like been in one of those situations and that's bothering you, that will bother you, right? So he finally had it, and he says, one day I complained to Suzuki Roshi. I told him all the problems I had with people not behaving the way I thought they ought to behave, if they were really practicing Zen, arriving late, taking long bathroom breaks, gossiping, being absent-minded or inattentive. Then I asked him for advice on how to get everyone to work with more concentration and vigor. He seemed to listen quite carefully, as though he understood my difficulty and was entirely sympathetic. Yes, you just can't get good help anymore, can you? When I finally ran out of complaints, he looked at me briefly, then responded, if you want to see virtue, you have to have a calm mind. I just love that. So it's, if you want to see virtue, you have to have a calm mind. And Brown was going, that's not what I asked you. That's not what I wanted to hear. And he was pretty frustrated with that for a while. And then he sat and he thought about what Suzuki was telling him. And he realized how quickly he would judge and scold and correct and reprimand his kitchen staff. And he thought rather he would calm his mind before he would react to them. So when he would get frustrated with his kitchen staff, rather than yell at me, just settle down and at least try to see what it was they were doing. Like the guy, he asked him to get 18 pounds of black beans, and a really long time later, S.B. Brown was going, you know, it just doesn't take that much time. I said 18 pounds, I think it was 18 cups of black beans. He's like, it just does not take that much time to get 18 cups of black beans. What is this person doing? And he went in there and he saw the person was piece by piece going through the beans to make sure it wasn't a stone and it was a bean. And his initial reaction was like, what are you doing? You know, but he calmed down, he saw what the person was doing and he worked with them. It wasn't that they should continue doing what they were doing, right? Because that was going to take forever. But rather, he worked with them. Ah, they're trying to, you know, get the beans and the stones separated. So he just said, I got a better way to do it. You know, put a bunch of beans out on a plate and pick the stones out that way. But that is what he got by listening to Suzuki, right? You can't see virtue, if you want to see virtue, you have to have a calm mind. So that's what we have to do. Not act from that idea right away, boom, but rather be in line with what it is that's taking place. We have a dream of how reality unfolding exactly as it should be. We have a dream of that. And it's like a straight line. That's how it is. That's our dream. That's if everything's working in complete harmony with one another, it just moves forward in a straight line. Everything's in sync, working together harmoniously, right? Isn't that it? Reality unfolding exactly as it should be? That's it. Just like that. But then we look at the world we live in, this very human world we live in, and it's filled with intention. It's filled with everyone dreaming the world, and it looks like this. It looks like we're going this way, and then they're going that way, and then somebody else is going this way, and they're going that way, right? It looks like that. And then we might see, we're going this way. This is the way it should be going. And then there's something going this way, there's something going this way. And we think of that as an impediment to realizing the straight line. We see that as an impediment to this. It's getting in our way. And in the meantime, there it is. It's this. We're in this human intentional world, and everybody's got their dreams of what this is. And some are in line with ours and some aren't. So our practices, life is, can we live that straight line that is in harmony with all beings in a world that seems to be out of harmony? Can we be this in the face of this? Can we do that? In this world of muddy water, and you've probably heard this before, can we live with purity like a lotus? So there's a chant that gets recited at our meditation retreats. And it starts out, in this world of emptiness, this is the world we live in, may we exist in muddy water with purity like a lotus. Muddy water. And if you've seen lotuses, you know they're pure white. They grow up out of the muddy water. Can we live? May we exist, it says, in muddy water with purity like a lotus. The world is muddy water. I actually painted this on the side of a building probably within a week. It was within a week of the George Floyd uprising. I went through the neighborhood where the greatest conflagration happened. Buildings were shut down, burned down. There's still husks all over. And somebody was doing an art project where we all got to share our thoughts. And they gave me a paintbrush, and I went, what am I going to paint? And I looked around at this world we were in. And I see, this is the world we live in, right here, writ large at that moment. This world of muddy water. And I painted, may we exist in muddy water with purity like a lotus. This world is muddy water. It's where lotuses flourish. And the lotus is the sign of wisdom, of enlightenment. Right here, wisdom, enlightenment flourishes in mud, in all those dreams. No mud, no wisdom, no mud, no life. So, rather than criticizing the dreams we encounter, reprimanding them, scolding them, putting them on the Procrustean bed. Do you know that story about Procrustes, the Procrustean bed? It was this bed. It's a Greek myth, so it gets a little gory. But it was this bed, and everything that was on it was made to fit the bed. So if you're too short, it'd stretch you out. And if you were too long, they'd lop off the stuff that was hanging off the sides. That's the Procrustean bed. This is how we live our life. So rather than doing that, rather than criticizing the dreams you encounter, can we accept them as the part of the workings of reality that they are. Can we do that? Not quiescence, right? Not loving, harmful behavior. That's not what this is. Think about what Edward S.P. Brown did when he encountered that person who's taking way too long to get the beans to him, right? He helped them. He saw what they were doing. He saw their dream. He met their dream. He helped them see that in a way that was less, but harmful. Or it just wasn't going to take so much time. So our usual ideas that we resist and fight and try to control this. But this right here, all that, this is where we stand upright. But just remember, no slant, no intention, no uprightness, no tumult, no disruption, right? No vicissitude, waves, whatever you want to call it, no quietude and peace. So there's a story about a Japanese poet that I want to share with you that I think is helpful as well to what I'm talking about. And again, I'm sharing a couple of my favorite stories. This is probably like a familiar theme that you've heard before, but just know you're hearing it because we need to hear it. We do this all the time. We're always doing it. We want to watch ourselves doing that, putting people on the Procrustean bed, right? Trying to make them conform to our dreams, not respecting their dreams. Not at least, and by respecting it, I just mean making room for it, realizing it for what it is, and not realizing when we're dreaming. So this is a familiar thing, but it's something we want to keep coming back to. We're doing this. We're dreaming the world. We have ideas about what it is. We have ideas about where it should be. This is what we do. This is what humans do. It's not wrong, right? But unless you face it, unless you really become aware of it, then you're just going to be acting out of those dreams all the time. And that's where harm can happen very quickly without our even knowing it, without our certainly not necessarily wanting it to happen. So anyhow, there's a story. So I'm sharing these favorite stories to try to bring this to life for us. But it's a story about the poet Ryokan. And I don't know if people know Ryokan, but there's a book that we have a biography about Ryokan. I'm going to be teaching a class in Ryokan this upcoming year called Holy Fool. And I don't know about you, but I love holy fools. They're my kind of people. And Ryokan was like, he was a poet and he was a monk. And he lived at the end of the 18th, beginning of the 19th century in Japan. He lived by himself, mainly. He would interact with people in the community, a lot with children. He had a kind of innocence and playfulness about him. One of the things about his character is that he didn't preach. He taught just by what he did. He didn't preach, and he didn't reprimand people. That just was not his nature. So the story I'm going to tell you, I know I've told this before, but it's about the day that his brother contacted him and just said, look, Ryokan, my son, so Ryokan's nephew, is misbehaving. Right? He's not fulfilling his obligations as a son. He's just behaving poorly. And I would like you, since you're, a great Buddhist teacher, I would like you to come and give him a talking to, help get him back in line. So Ryokan accepted the invitation to go to his brother's house. Then he went there, and he didn't say anything to the son. They just stayed overnight, and then he was leaving the next morning. And when he was leaving, the son was helping Ryokan put his shoes on, his sandals. And this is a way to respect one's elders, right? Here's the elderly Ryokan. He's staying with him. So the son is respecting his elders by doing this. And perhaps he's really helping Ryokan out. This older man, helping him get his shoes tied. And as he was doing that, He felt a warm drop of water. And he looked up and he saw that Ryokan was looking down at him, his eyes full of tears. That was it. And Ryokan returned to his hut. And the nephew changed. And his life got back online again. He was so touched by Ryokan, by Ryokan's gratitude, his wholehearted gratitude and appreciation for just that simple gesture of tying those sandals. Just like Edward S.B. Brown, who began to look at his own mind and only give from a mind not clinging to its dreams about what Zen should look like. Ryokan's nephew is moved not by scolding, but by Ryokan's love, by his gratitude, by his acceptance of his nephew, this delinquent son, this wayward son, his acceptance of just this small, kind act, wholeheartedly. There is peace. There is quietude. And that quietude, again, is right here. Always. Even in the convolutions of the myriad dreams, our own and others. It's right here, working in the fire, working through the fire, all beings assisting one another in this fire as this fire. Reality quietly, completely working out reality. We can see that. We can see that right amidst the dream. We have to. We have to see it right amidst the dream. There's no other place we can see it. That's where we are. And in doing so, we can see the whole human world dreaming, including each one of us. And we can accept it and love it and live accordingly. And that doesn't mean to indulge those dreams, but to realize that they are dreams and not indulge them, but rather open ourselves back up to all of this, which includes everyone dreaming, including ourselves, and act with understanding, love, and compassion. So that's my talk. I don't know if people have anything they want to share, things you've been noticing, things are on your mind, either from my talk or just what's been going on. As we noted last week, pretty crazy right now. Yeah, Roger.
You're proposing that, let's just say somebody is sitting in this chair named Frank, and Frank could have a vision of a better Frank, and he can move to it by some choices and steps he would make in his life. Is that correct?
Oops, I missed the last part of that. So I heard the...
Oh, Frank could see a better, imagine a better, more peaceful self, and he could move to it by making some changes in his life. And
so you're wondering about Frank and not about Roger?
Well, I'm just using an example. I don't want to personalize it. I'm just saying...
Yeah.
But let's take another person, Suzuki Roshi himself. I don't know what book I read this in, but Suzuki Roshi had a son who came to the United States and found that all these students admired him, his disposition, and he seemed to be a sort of perfect person. And the son almost laughed and said, this is not the man I knew as my father. He had a violent temper. And he treated me badly sometimes. So did Suzuki reform himself maybe and become a wise and kind and peaceful man? Or was it that first and foremost, he had a wife who was always taking care of all of his needs? And then he found students who adored him and admired him. So did he change himself, or did people around him create, was it outside people? And you know, it's an interesting matter because, for example, as some of you know, and as I've talked about, I was around Shohaku Kimura quite a lot when he came to Minneapolis. And one thing I noticed about him was that starting with his wife, everybody was taking care of his, you know, doing his laundry, and people were giving him money all the time. And the calmness of Shohaku Okumura, the calmness of him came about partly because so many people were eager to help him and treat him. And even once I went to a session that he led, and he had, what's the word for Tenzo? His top assistant monk.
Oh,
it was an older lady. He had this is again Choco Kimura. He had met this woman out in California, and she followed him to. And at this session, somehow or other, I began to think just what I'm thinking now. Maybe people are making life too pleasant for Shakuhu, and that's where his peace and actually this woman seemed to read my mind. Because during the session, I must have been sitting thinking these. And she said later, Roger, I want to talk to you. I want to go outside and talk to you. And anyhow, so I put this to his number one assistant. I think Shohaku is somehow or other going to be ruined in America because now everybody is taking care of his problems. And she said, I think that is so, but that's the way it has to be. So I'm still pondering that. That's decades ago that she was sort of saying, maybe Zen people have to have put somebody on a pedestal to be their wisdom speaker, something like that. Anyhow.
Yeah.
I'm still wondering about that. I know I'm more peaceful now because I've become so old. So lots of things have gone away for me. So it makes me calmer because I will soon be able to do nothing at all. But it is an interesting question. I think what you say is true, but, is it a question of that we are going to make decisions, 1, 2, 3, 4, we're going to take care of the money issues in our life, and then we're going to take care of our diet, or we're going to take care of the kind of friends we have around us. But I think you're right. We have to take steps toward peace. And, it's a tricky thing to figure out for each person what are the steps they are going to take.
Well, thank you, Roger. That was a treasure trove of ideas and questions that I think are worth thinking about. You know, one of the things I liked about what you said was that we're not in this alone, right? That we are working with other people, but sometimes it is, you know, you can see in a situation where everything seems to be moving towards a common goal and everybody's, you know, well, I'll take care of this. I'll do this so that this can happen. And, but sometimes it doesn't seem that way. It seems like things are getting in the way. And I don't know about the rest of you. I think you were kind of saying this yourself, that sometimes, right, that getting in the way, if we can be open to it, is showing us something, right? And that really what I liked about what you were saying, though, is that everything's working together. That is what we want to wake up to. Even when it seems like they're not, that's what I'm trying to say is reality. This thing that we can't, you know, I gesture like this, but it's sit on my hands for a second because it's not that. It's just this is all beings working together to bring this about. It's always that way. So I really like that about your, one of the things that you were observing is that, yeah, this is it's working together for sure. There was something else you said. It was about the things we have to take care of in our life, right? That's that intentional world. This is what I was saying before. The human world is an intentional world. You can't get away from that. So sometimes people will hear these teachings, again, something like what Steve is pointing out with nature, the way that it unfolds, the way that it produces and gets things done. And then they look at their lives and they go, but I have to, you know, I have to do things. I live in a world where I have intentions to bring things about. Well, yes, that's what I'm trying to help us see is that that is the world we live in. It's muddy, right? That's another way that we see it. And that's where we can, that is where we have to wake up. That is the world we live in. So when we're acting intentionally, it's that extra step of, are we aware of what we're doing? Are we, so to think about that gene, are we remembering that when we have intentions and dreaming the world? Right? So we can take those intentions we have lightly if we realize that it's just some ideas I have. But if we don't, if we think that the ideas we have are right and the right way to do things, then we can have some problems. So thinking again about Suzuki, you know, he was pointing out to his students at one point, he goes, you know, right now, Tassajara is like this, and the organization is like this, and people are like this, and so this is the way we do things. But it's not always going to be that way. It just isn't always going to be that way, so we'll have to change what it is we're doing. We're going to have to, you know, adjust to what it is that's showing up now. And so we can't always do it the same way, right? So we're always looking at what the situation is. And rather than imposing, so Suzuki's Tassajara, they had a way of doing things, but you don't hold it too heavily. You don't hold on to it too tightly and go, no, this is the way you do this. Not now, not in these circumstances, not in these conditions. So again, then we're getting back to that mutually assisting. You know, if we're seeing how everything's assisting each other, we can see, if not necessarily a path forward, we can see how to move forward as we're finding our path. So, but anyhow, you said a lot of great stuff there, Roger. So I hope I got to some of that.
I just want to come back to Ryokan. He chose a life where he was going to have virtually no clothing, no possessions. He chose a life where he was just going to go around and beg food. So these are wonderful poems, and I think everybody should read them who's interested in Zen. But
I agree.
He chose a life of wanting almost nothing.
Yeah. And it expressed in the particular way he chose. But that's not the only way to do it, for sure.
And he wrote poems. He lived in a very small hut.
Yeah.
And often had very little to eat, and he wrote poems.
Yeah. Just a story about Ryokan that I liked was, you know, so he lived in a hut, just like Roger was saying, and there was a plant growing. And rather than pluck the plant, he saw that it was going to grow up through the roof of his hut, so he cut a hole in the roof of his hut. And I'm not saying that that's how we need to live our life, but think about the spirit behind that, like what it is that he sees. A friend of mine's husband, and I know this guy, he's really something else. That's all I got to say. This guy's just something. It's just a joy to be around. But she came home and she realized that her husband had cut holes in the ceilings and the floor, like from the children's room. He just cut holes in the house. And she's like, what on earth did you do? And he goes, well, the kids wanted to play a game where they were like, I don't know, they wanted secret entrances or whatever. So I cut some for her. She's like, no, you can't just do that. But again, it's not whether that was wise, but there's something in the intentionality of that. Okay, there's a wall here, but the kids want to walk through it. So we'll make a hole for them to walk through, you know? There's something about that, not holding again to our ideas. And this guy is really fantastic. He's a very talented fiddle player. And there's just some very fun stories about his interaction with famous people, like Lou Reed hiring him, or thought he hired him to play a gig with him until the guy didn't show up because he was going fishing instead. You know, hard person maybe sometimes to be around, but you know what I'm saying? Like, I agree with you. I think what Ria kind of did was beautiful. And we all have to find our way, but that way, what I think is great for Ryokan and what's great for this fiddle player that I know is really the spirit, the intention, the flexibility, the openness. Oh, that's how it is. Okay. That's what I'm going to do. You know, but we have to, one thing the fiddle player doesn't do is we live with other people. So he's certainly making things difficult for people sometimes in what he did still. Again, thank you, Roger. Yeah. Anything else people want to talk about? Looks like we actually have sun. So here's one of those hanging on to things too tightly. I bet people do this. I was looking at my weather app, and I had hoped to go for a bicycle ride today. I went for one yesterday, and it was a nice. I haven't been on my bike in a while, so it was just nice to do to get out on the bike. And it was but cloudy, so it was not my idea of what a good day should be like. But there I was having this wonderful bike ride. So then anyhow, I thought, well, I want to go for a bike ride today. And I looked at my weather app and it looked like it was going to be more clouds. And I went, oh, but I want the sun. Now the sun's out. So things are coming my way. Yeah, Kaylee. Yeah, Mike, go ahead.
Yes. You know, I really enjoyed your talk today. And I've noticed here lately that, yeah, I mean, sometimes... Well, I see the similarities between, you know, being awake and dreaming. You know, sometimes, you know, am I dreaming? I'm awake. Or am I awake and dreaming? You know, sometimes it's hard to tell. So living out of our dreams was really an appropriate title, I think.
Yeah. But my title had a double edge to it, living out of our dreams, right? So on one hand, we're dreaming, but we don't have to be caught up in the dream. You know, we can wear that lightly and not be caught in it. So I appreciate that. You're right. I mean, here we are, right? And sometimes it's hard to tell, but we can tell. And we can tell by realizing we're dreaming. That helps. And that helps us to see this is dream. These are my ideas. This is my take on them. And then we don't have to yell at the guy for taking 2 hours to get 18 cups of beans or whatever was going on there. Anything else anyone wants to share anything about? Yeah, Mary.
So I didn't study mythology in school, but I was at a thrift store and picked up a book on the importance of myth. And I briefly read the story of Icarus. And turns out it's very Zen. I always thought that the lesson was, you know, that he was punished because he just had to keep rolling the ball up and then it would fall down. But the author said that it really represents the importance of the process of life and living, of not having that goal of getting up, but just, you know, plodding along and doing your thing. And then if it rolls down, okay, just do it all over again. So your talk reminded me of that.
Well, thanks for sharing, Mary. I love the story of Sisyphus. So yeah, I appreciate that. Well, I saw we have more rhubarb crumble downstairs. And it's pretty good. So I'll let us to it. So thank you.
Thank you for listening. To hear more talks on Buddhism, Zen, and related topics, visit dharmafield.org.